Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we open our show with information on actions being sought by Governor Gavin Newsom to protect Californians from repeated power outages as outrage grows over utilities leaving people powerless with fires raging across the state. Then we'll have a special report on the Cajon Valley Union School District, which spent over $500,000 on promotional videos, money some parents and taxpayers say would be better used to improve school safety and help schools that are failing state standards for math and English. On People Power, hear about a great pumpkin grown in Santee that's the biggest ever in San Diego County. Our newsmaker interview today is with Renee Owens from Wild Zone Conservation. She'll be talking about mountain lions, including efforts afoot to gain endangered species status for the big cats. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show, where East County matters. And please, listeners, stay safe out there during this peak fire season. Tens of thousands of San Diego County residents have been left without power in recent days due to outages imposed by San Diego Gas and Electric Company, or SDG&E, to prevent wildfires during Santa Ana winds, with fires raging across Southern California. Now, Governor Gavin Newsom has asked the California Public Utilities Commission to come up with new rules to limit intentional outages, penalize utilities for excessive outages, and compensate people left without power. The new governor has appointed two new PUC commissioners and made clear at a press conference that he expects to see meaningful reforms. Governor Newsom says utilities must be held accountable for widespread outages and customers should not be charged during those outages. He also announced the launch of a new state website with resources for Californians impacted by wildfires and utility-directed power shutoffs, and that site is response.ca.gov. Newsom announced that PG&E has agreed to credit its ratepayers for time that they were blacked out, but SDG&E is refusing to do the same. In response to our inquiry, SDG&E Communications Manager Wes Jones responded that the company abides by rules set by the PUC, adding, per that process, SDG&E is not liable for circumstances beyond our control, including weather conditions like those we have been experiencing this month. Now, that means even ratepayers who suffer losses, such as food spoilage or lost business due to outages, currently have no recourse for compensation if those outages were to prevent fires. Now, the utility will accept claims for losses during planned outages for other purposes, such as for repairs, if that takes longer than expected. Customers have to provide receipts for evaluation of those claims. But for local ratepayers left in the dark for days at a time, in some cases repeatedly due to outages to prevent fires, there's no help, leaving residents powerless in more ways than one. Some ratepayers have voiced smoldering rage at the situation. Alpine resident Lou Russo says he and his family had to go to a motel recently, and not for the first time, because without electricity they have no heat or water. He voiced anger at being charged for usage when his household has no power, while still paying fire fees and higher fire insurance rates. In Lakeside, retired firefighter Barry Trehe, who previously lost a home in a wildfire, told us, "We are seniors and have a 10,000-gallon water tank on our property for firefighting purposes. They also have fire sprinklers. But all of that relies on electric power for the well pump. He believes if SDG&E shuts off his power and leaves his family defenseless, the utility should be liable if a fire damages or destroys their home." At a town hall meeting in Julian, October 25th, held during power outages across East County as a fire burned in nearby Ramona, Supervisor Diane Jacob also criticized the shutoffs. "Two-thirds of East County depends on wells," she said, noting that during outages, residents have no way to get water, including to fight fires. She wants to see SDG&E provide generators as mitigation, but she also faulted the utility for shutting off power instead of fire-hardening lines and spending money to underground more lines at a faster rate. She says it's all about the money. Outages also leave some residents without communications when computers and phones dependent on electricity fail. Even cell service has been lost in some places due to outages, raising the risk that residents won't receive evacuation notices if a fire does occur. Power shutoffs also slow evacuations when traffic signals go out and cause other problems, such as forcing shutdown of 8 rural school districts on Thursday. SDG&E spokesman Eugene Mitch Mitchell said at the town hall that SDG&E already undergrounds 60% of its lines, which he says is more than any other utility in the nation, and plans to do more in the future, but rocky terrain prevents undergrounding everywhere. Supervisor Jacobs says she will ask the state to waive some environmental requirements to allow SDG&E to complete its upgrades that would limit outages at a faster pace. For the latest information on local outages, anticipated or in progress, you can visit sdge.com. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Gerald Stevenson with a special report from East County Magazine on what critics are calling extravagant spending by the Cajon Valley Union School District on videos to market and promote itself. The Internet has revolutionized video marketing, enabling small businesses and government agencies to directly promote their messages to target audiences online. Using taxpayer money, the Cajon Valley District has hired professional videographers and choreographers to create video marketing and promotional messages posted on its YouTube channel and other social media. These range from videos about its World of Work career path program to videos such as a day in the life of a Cajon Valley bus driver to an invitation to a Grandparents Day event. The district also produces a monthly broadcast with news and events directed to school personnel and staff. But these videos come with a high price tag. According to documents obtained by East County Magazine through public records requests, the district has spent over $500,000, $576,289.60 to be exact, on promotional videos in the 5 years since David Miyashiro became superintendent of the district. This doesn't count any money that may have been spent on videos for other purposes, such as educational videos shown in classrooms. Payments were made to several video producers, including Ron Cook Media, Target River, Seal Media Productions, Vandela Media, Media Arts Center, the San Diego County Office of Education and EdTech Productions, and others. East County Magazine repeatedly asked Superintendent Miyashiro and School Board President Tamara Otero for an interview, but both refused to respond to questions. In the past, both have repeatedly claimed that the videos benefit the district. But when East County Magazine sent a pointed records request asking for documentation of any financial benefits or increased enrollment directly attributable to the videos, the district's executive coordinator, Naomi Rodriguez, sent an email back stating that there are no responsive records. Also troubling, most of those videos have had very limited viewings. Of the 194 videos produced and uploaded by the district to its YouTube site, some have had as few as 22 viewings, with most averaging between 150 and 250 views. A flash mob video, however, in which students and Superintendent Miyashiro are shown dancing at Parkway Plaza, has had upwards of 64,000 views and has been touted as boosting student morale. It has drawn positive comments from parents and students on social media, but at a hefty cost of over $21,000. The flash mob video was produced by Media Arts Project, a San Diego-based video cooperative. The company Misnomer, Inc., doing business as BookAFlashMob.com, provided creative direction including choreography, music, and costumes for the flash mob video. On its website, the company boasts that it had been hired by such high-profile entities as Disney, the NBA, Live Nation, MTV, Google, Pepsi, T-Mobile, and more, including over 10% of Fortune 500 companies. From 2017 through June 2019, Media Arts Project has taken in $139,000 for its video work for the district, while in the same time period, Ron Cook Media was paid $75,000. That's a total of nearly $200,000 spent in just the past 2 years. We sent a public records request to the district's top officials requesting final project costs and accounting for the flash mob video back on September 6th, but the district failed to comply, violating the California Public Records Act, a pattern with this district, which has complied with some past records requests only after lawyers representing our media outlet sent letters threatening legal action. For other district video projects, Miyashiro entered into another agreement with Ron Cook Media in late August to pay the company up to $40,000 for video production services through December 31st. Ron Cook Media owners Karen and Ron Cook recently had a portable building named the Karen and Ron Cook Studio established at Flying Hills Elementary School on district property. Cook initially objected to being asked about the arrangement, but later said the building was dedicated to the Cooks due to their generous donations to the district, even though the company has been paid substantial sums for its video production work. Back to the flash mob video, its initial funding was approved on a 3-to-1 vote in May. School board trustee Jim Miller, who calls himself a fiscally conservative Republican, made a motion to approve the expenditure. His motion was seconded by Karen Clark Mejia, with Board of Trustees President Tamara Otero also voting in favor. Trustee Joe Alegria was not present. Trustee Jill Bardo voted against the expenditure. She said, "I'm not against doing the videos, but we need to be spending money on making our schools more secure for our students." Her remark refers to a December 2018 report by a security consultant hired by the district in response to a county grand jury report that urged local districts to improve security to protect students. That report recommended costly upgrades to make schools safer after recent mass shootings, but the district has indicated it does not have enough money for those upgrades without passage of a bond measure. Such passage is far from assured in a district where many families are low income. Safety upgrades aren't the only unfunded needs. In recent school board meetings, during public testimony, teachers and others have asked for funds to repair or upgrade aging school facilities. Parents have also raised concern about 25% of the district's schools failing to meet state standards in math and English, as measured by the California dashboard tests. Superintendent Miyashiro has dismissed those concerns, claiming the state is testing the wrong metrics. To date, the district has not outlined any steps to improve low test scores at those schools. Cajon Valley's high spending on videos could become a thorn in the district's side next year when it asks voters to approve a bond measure of up to $500 million to fund security upgrades, but only $1.2 million is slated to be allocated for security upgrades if the bond is approved, according to a draft facilities needs list. Other bond funds are reportedly slated for building infrastructure, new construction, renovations, site improvements, and technology. If no money had been spent on videos, the savings could, at best, have funded less than half of the recommended security upgrades in the consultant's report, not counting other district facility needs, and would come nowhere close to the $500 million that the district is asking voters to approve in bond obligations over the next 34 years. The $500,000 that the Cajon Valley District has spent on promotional videos over the past 5 years appears to be even more excessive when compared to spending in other neighboring East County school districts. East County Magazine sent records requests to the La Mesa Spring Valley School District, Lakeside Unified School District, and Grossmont Union High School District produced rapid responses. All had dramatically lower expenditures on marketing and promotional videos. La Mesa Spring Valley spent no money on marketing or promotional videos from July 2014 to June 2018. From July 2018 to June 2019, the district spent $14,500 to produce 29 videos. The Lakeside District spent approximately $5,500 on 4 marketing, publicity, or promotional videos from July 2014 through July 2019. Both the La Mesa Spring Valley and Lakeside districts operate elementary and middle schools like Cajon Valley. Yet even the far larger Grossmont Union School District indicated that it has spent just $7,950 on 5 videos in recent years. The average cost of each Cajon Valley video ends up being just over $3,000, while the neighboring district spending on videos ranged from $500 to $1,500 apiece. Some community members are voicing anger over the district's lavish spending on videos. Local community activist Estela Del Los Rios says, "These are outrageous expenditures. Enough is enough. Our students need and deserve the best education. She voiced concerns over lack of spending by the district on security, as well as ignoring calls from parents to address bullying despite numerous bullying incidents reported. De Los Rios concludes, "This superintendent's priorities are definitely in the wrong place and definitely unethical. Parents and community should be concerned," she said, adding, "These are our children, our future leaders, and the district should be focusing on their best interests, not senseless videos which are self-serving to an individual who's wasting our tax dollars. We pay his salary. He works for us." Ray Lutz, founder of Citizens Oversight Project, a nonprofit government watchdog organization based in El Cajon, also expressed his disdain for the videos and Miyashiro. Lutz says, "It seems the Cajon Valley School District is more interested in cheap promotional clicks on viral videos than it is on its core mission, education. Are they spending a similar sum on truly educational videos that will help students do better in school?" he asked. "This spending of more than $500,000 on these ridiculous YouTube videos is an embarrassment." East County Magazine also requested comments on findings of our investigation from the San Diego Taxpayers Association, which holds the annual Golden Fleece Awards to draw attention to extravagant expenditures by public agencies. But the group's president and CEO, Haney Hong, declined to comment despite repeated requests.
This is East County Magazine's People Power, profiling local people making a positive difference in our community and our world.
The Fredericks family of Santee has grown a whopper of a pumpkin, tipping the scales at 1,531 pounds. The giant gourd is the largest ever grown in San Diego County. It took second place at the pumpkin competition weigh-off in Irvine on September 21st, however missing the all-time Southern California record by just 2 pounds. The biggest statewide was a 1,758-pound pumpkin grown in Napa. Jim Fredericks says he first started growing pumpkins as a child, graduating to giant pumpkins starting in 2001. He and a friend grew a pumpkin that weighed over 1,100 pounds back in 2012, setting a county record that lasted until last year, and which he and his family reclaimed with this year's Goliath gourd. This year's prize winner was grown with help from his wife, Sarah, and their sons, 5-year-old Andrew and 8-year-old Joshua. Frederick says he got inspired by a website on how to grow giant pumpkins, and now he shares his tips with others. Lots of work in the pumpkin patch every day, disease control, lots of water, the right seeds, good soil, and a little luck, he says. He predicts the new record of 1,531 pounds will be hard to beat, since pumpkins don't grow as well in hot climates as they do in colder northern areas. The world's record for the biggest pumpkin ever is held by a New Hampshire farmer who grew a 2,307-pounder. The term Great Pumpkin was popularized by Charles Schulz, author of the popular Peanuts cartoon strip in which Charlie Brown waited each Halloween for the Great Pumpkin to appear. Appropriately, the Fredericks family posed with their prized pumpkin wearing Charlie Brown t-shirts. The Fredericks family grew their prize-winning pumpkin in just 85 days, and it plumped up by as much as 43 pounds in a single day. So how do you move a pumpkin that weighs over 3/4 of a ton? The Fredericks used a crane to hoist it into a U-Haul trailer for the ride up to Irvine for the weigh-off. After 3 weeks of display at the Irvine Railroad Park, the giant pumpkin will return to East County, where it will be displayed at Shadow Mountain Church in El Cajon. Ultimately, Frederick says, it will be carved up and the seeds saved in hopes of cultivating an even bigger pumpkin in the future. Reporting for East County Magazine in Santee, this is Jonathan Goetz.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio here in East County. Today, we are going to be talking about mountain lions, and we've got a real expert with us, Renee Owens with WildZoneConservation.org. She is a wildlife biologist, and she's been doing some studies on mountain lions. Renee, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's start by talking about the status of mountain lions in California, which has changed quite a bit in recent years.
Yeah, there's a lot of buzz going on about mountain lions, which is tends to happen when you get something like the recent event in Penasquitos Canyon, where one was shot after it harassed some people. And so when that happens, there's a whole lot of misinformation. So one of the most important things is to talk about what we do know about this otherwise rather mysterious creature.
Definitely. And the other end of the spectrum, on one hand, there's concerns raised anytime there's a lion that, you know, that maybe attacks somebody or stalks somebody, has happened there. But also, the other side of the coin, people get concerned when we start to see mountain lions getting killed on the highways. Just mm-hmm. in the last couple of weeks, there were two of them killed crossing a freeway in L.A., and one right here in East County trying to cross Highway 67. And coincidentally, that happened in the very same spot where I saw a dead mountain lion on that same curve in the road a couple of years ago. So I understand about 10 years ago or so, they banned hunting of mountain lions, although people were still allowed, say, a rancher or someone could get a depredation permit to kill one if it was going after livestock or pets or something.
Yeah, so let's start there. It's known as Prop 117, and it was came into law a while ago. The Californians made it very clear that they don't want to see mountain lions hunted, trophy hunted.
Right.
So that is illegal in our state, and unlike a lot of other states, but they can be killed by way of, as you said, if they kill livestock, it is possible to get what's called a depredation permit. And those are not uncommon.
How many a year are killed that way?
Unfortunately, it depends how many are actually used, but on average, changes each year, but on average, there are about 200 or more given out each year.
Wow. And how many lions that we know of die of other causes, like poisoning? Rat poison, I know, is a big thing, or being hit by cars.
Well, that's a good question. Nationwide, we know that over 3,000 mountain lions are reported as dying a year. That's a lot. And there are, of course, others that we don't know about. I even know of one. I went hiking a couple years ago south of Crest, where I take the dogs, and one of my dogs is a tracking dog, and actually found a carcass of a mountain lion that
wow.
had been poached, its head and tail removed.
Oh.
So I knew it was a poaching incident. So even though that's not as common, what we know now, especially in California and what we're seeing in the news, heck, they're even on 60 Minutes. There was a story about our Los Angelian mountain lions.
Yeah, because, kind of a celebrity lion up
yeah,
there.
Yeah, and so their habitat is becoming fragmented. And you're going to hear that word a lot because it's really important. When you're an animal that needs 150 and can use up to 400 square mile territory, you have to cross roads, and that's dangerous. And so places like Southern California, the number one cause of mortality to mountain lions, right up there at the top, is getting hit by cars.
Do we know how many are killed by cars in California every year?
I don't have a statistic for that, except we've looked at different populations. Like, they recognize 10 different populations just in California. So they tend to study each population at a time. But we do know from radio-collared animals that a lot of them get hit by cars. And the other cause of mortality of mountain lions in many places is also being killed by other males. They're highly territorial.
Yeah, and I should mention both of the lions that were killed in Lakeside that I'm aware of by cars did mm-hmm. did not have collars, so they mm-hmm. may not have shown up
exactly.
on any statistics.
Yeah, so that's the other thing is And let me say, one of the most common questions is, how many? How many are there in our county? How many in the state?
Good
and
question.
You're not going to always hear a solid number. And when people ask me, they're not really satisfied because I don't give a nice statistic. And I'll tell you why. There's a couple reasons. So the first reason is counting mountain lions isn't like counting your children. Okay. It's tough and it changes. It's not static.
They're pretty reclusive too. They tend.
Exactly.
Unlike coyotes that we see all over, they tend to come out and hunt at night when people aren't up and about.
So number one, it's not easy to get a solid number. And there are models to estimate them because it can really depend on how many males and females and young and older ones, which is dynamic and changes. But there's another reason why, as somebody like myself, I've been a wildlife biologist, conservation biologist for 30 years. And when you look at how we create policy, when you put these numbers out there, as much as they're informative to certain people, then the animal becomes a number. And we ignore the really important things like behavior and dynamics of populations that are even more important overall.
And we'll talk some more about that in a minute. But first, I wanted to go back to the status. There is an effort now by some of the conservation groups, I understand, that are trying to seek endangered species status for mountain lions in at least some California regions. Can you give us some details on that?
Yeah, that's correct. So right now, the Mountain Lion Foundation and the Center for Biological Diversity have petitioned. The formal name of when you propose a species is listed as protected, and this happens to be under the California Endangered Species Act. And that's because their populations have become so fragmented that they literally are in danger of extinction. These different populations are so isolated here in Southern California. We know it's happening from all the research they've done and the DNA research in the LA area. And we suspect it's also happening here in San Diego. There's ongoing research that we're going to hear more about soon as they conclude this, but we definitely do know that mountain lions in this county are not, you'll hear these reports of their numbers are exploding. That's simply not true. They are actually on the decline. So getting a real handle on the nature of that decline is what we're looking at as far as numbers. And like I said, it has everything to do with habitat fragmentation and how difficult. Imagine if you had to travel even 100 square miles without coming near people or crossing major highways.
Yeah, and they do. They'll travel, 100 miles in a night or a week or something?
Some can. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They can really move.
Yeah, I know they had one killed in Jamul, and it had been tracked as far as the beach up in Pendleton or San Clemente or somewhere. It had gone a very long way. If they were to get the endangered species status, what does that mean in terms of how that might affect things like future developments and roadway building and so forth?
One of the really great things about it is that it would push policy where it's lacking now. And that is, like you said, the key word, corridors. When we see developments, when we have roads, expansions, you name it, the thing that is missing are wildlife corridors. And we don't want to wait like Los Angeles is, till the animals are already endangered at risk of extinction. They're putting a wildlife corridor up that is over many lanes, and it's in LA, so it's hugely expensive. You know, it's a lot cheaper to be proactive. Mm-hmm. We're not good at that yet. So we have all of these roads and very few wildlife corridors, and we need to maintain them too. For example, there are underpasses. There's one between Mission Gorge and Miramar under the 52. But they've put a fence up.
Oh, well,
so there are all these things that aren't rocket science that we can do.
Yeah, and some places
we
they
just
do
don't
overpasses, and it's interesting. I've seen photos of these where it's kind of like picture like a bridge with landscaping mm-hmm. on top of it just for wildlife.
We can do that. We can go under roads. Mm-hmm. It's just not a priority when it comes to these developments, and it really needs to be. And that means we have to work it into policy somehow.
So now they might have to mitigate for damage to wildlife habitat, to mountain lion habitat, mm-hmm. and corridors if they were declared
endangered. Yeah, because that's the future of the world of mountain lions. Mm-hmm. More people, more development, mm-hmm. more sprawl.
Not just lions. I mean, yeah. bobcats, deer, exactly. other kind of large animals would also benefit from these corridors.
Exactly. And that follows to the point that some listeners might have heard how mountain lion is a top predator. Some people call them a keystone predator, but they're like in a house of cards. You pull out that one predator, that top predator, and the whole thing can fall apart. So they really are representative. They are the ultimate canary in the coal mine, because having mountain lions as a top predator means you have a more healthy ecosystem. And when they're removed, and we've seen the results of this through overhunting and other causes.
Right. Kind of like the wolves in Yellowstone.
Exactly. The ecosystem is not the same, and it's worse for losing that top predator. Things are really connected in Mother Nature.
So people who may not know a lot about mountain lions, which, by the way, are also called pumas or cougars, various other names, tell us a little bit about them. What do they eat?
So, yes, we do know a lot of things like that about them. And their number one top prey are deer. If there are elk around, they also like elk. They're cats. So they have a wide variety of prey, but we know for sure deer are right up there, the majority of what they like to
number
eat.
Number one entree, venison.
Yeah. Okay. And that is important to know, because if you have a lot of deer that overgraze because now there are no mountain lions, they've been hunted out, then that's a problem for the entire ecosystem. And it's not a problem, by the way, that has been resolved by human hunting. We hear that. It doesn't work that way.
Well, I read a very interesting story that said, on the East Coast, where the East Coast cougar is now extinct, they've had an explosion of deer, which means an explosion of deer ticks, which means an explosion of Lyme disease mm-hmm. and other tick-borne illnesses. So you're right. It's like John Muir used to say, you know, everything in nature is kind of hitched to everything else.
It is. We don't just wax poetic for the fun of it. It's true. And there are other things that deer can have that are a problem, like a wasting disease. And mountain lions will pick off these deer first because they're easier to catch. If they're slower, they're diseased. Hunters don't do that.
No, I hear complaints from hunters locally. There's been one local backcountry forum, you know, where there's people have sort of railed about this, and they contend that they're not seeing as many deer as they used to, and they blame that on the mountain lions. Mm-hmm. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I've heard that. And I do have to say, like I said, after 30 years of studying all kinds of predators, my pet peeve is that often hunters are interviewed as if they're experts, mm-hmm. and they aren't. The biologists are the experts. And I'm sorry, but we're not in the fantastical days of Last of the Mohicans with Natty Bumppo. The more hunters put out their opinions, that's adopted as fact. And that's unfortunate, because that leads to a lot of misnomers, such as, like you say, about the deer. I have heard lately this idea that we have fewer deer and therefore mountain lions are going to fill in the blank. That's actually not true. We don't suddenly have plummeting deer populations.
And how do we know this? Is there a count that's done?
They do study deer. You know, deer are top animal species that people like to hunt. So the agencies do pay attention
because
quite a bit.
They decide how many permits to issue.
Exactly.
Each year. Okay.
So
and it should be noted, too, that of course, even if there was a decline in the deer population in some years, it's not necessarily because of lions. We have a lot of wildfires, for instance, that burn a lot of habitat.
Oh,
there's climate change.
It certainly won't be because of lions, because there's a predator-prey balance that's been going on well before humans ever got here. So the reason this idea of fewer deer is popping up is, from what I can see, is that because there's always some people who live in the backcountry and they see the mountain lions, or they have a goat or a sheep that they has been predated. So they immediately think mountain lion, which is certainly possible. It's actually quite rare, but we know it's possible. And so they then was, oh, what's happening? What's happening? They're switching prey. Nope. If you house your livestock in the backcountry and they're easy to get to, you don't bring them in, you don't have a roof over your pen or what have you, they're a snack waiting.
So you should keep your livestock in at night, your sheep, your mm-hmm. goats, and so forth. What else could be done to protect livestock? And we should mention not only from mountain lions, but what's actually much more common is coyotes mm-hmm. taking, say, a goat or a sheep. What else can people do if they own livestock to protect them without having to go get a predation permit to kill a lion if they believe that a lion might be a threat in their area?
Good question. Two-pronged answer. So the first thing to be aware of is that you get a depredation permit if you know it's a mountain lion, not just because you're guessing. People who do that need to know that when you remove a mountain lion from habitat, especially places like ours where they're so fragmented and they're really vying for good habitat, another one's going to move in eventually. So you are not, it's not a long-term solution
so
to
what
the
is?
Problem. The long-term solution is to treat your livestock just like you would your beloved house pet, where you keep them safe. And if you're not sure how to do that, there are groups that can help you. The Mountain Lion Foundation loves to go out and help show you how to build it, make it safe. For example, there's no fencing that's tall enough, unless you live in the Chrysler Building, mm-hmm. To keep a mountain lion out. You need a roof. You need to bring them in. And I have spoken to so many people in different states who've complained, ranchers who've complained that their sheep or their goats have been taken by a mountain lion. Come to find out, oftentimes it wasn't a mountain lion. And if and when it was, it's because they didn't bring them in to housing at night that kept them safe, quite simply.
Now, I know sometimes a rancher may have a very large herd and maybe doesn't have the resources right now to go build a huge barn. Is having certain types of shepherd dogs another option to protect your herd?
Yep, there's definitely a couple breeds of dogs that are excellent and are used by more commercial ranchers mm-hmm. to help, and they work. And in fact, depending, sometimes even donkeys and other things can be good watchdogs. Depends on the scenario and the size.
Yeah.
What I always say is that our solutions, because ultimately we are smarter than the mountain lion. So we
right.
just have to apply what we know. And there are a lot of people who really are willing to help you. Let's say you don't have what you need to build this or to find the right dog. And there are lots of resources out there. We have that on our website.
What about methods of hazing to keep a lion away, such as with lights or noise or motion sensors?
Yeah, in fact, one of the amendments to California state law is that in areas, especially around LA, where mountain lions are so rare now, probably endangered, you can't seek a depredation permit right away when your livestock has knowingly been predated by a mountain lion. Instead, the first thing you have to do is try hazing, something non-lethal, and often can work. Lights, noises. Mountain lions are extremely reclusive, and even though food is a very powerful motivation, mm-hmm. we all know that, they can be scared off. There was actually an interesting study done just recently about just the voice of humans and how much different wildlife species avoid
that was funny,
it.
A particular voice, I understand.
Yes.
Drove the mountain lions and, away.
And the mountain lions and a host of other species, not surprisingly, really avoided just our voices. And when you think about it, we know the mountain lions are out there seeing us way more than we see them. And if they truly wanted us, if we were on the menu, there'd be a heck of a lot more of us being attacked by mountain lions.
Exactly.
So,
the study you alluded to is the one that I read, at least, mentioned that they were actually playing voices of Rush Limbaugh, and the mountain lions didn't like that.
The researchers played recordings of Rush Limbaugh, and then when they were reviewing the data, they had to listen to him, and they said they got so tired of it that they decided instead to read poetry.
Oh, that's funny.
But the mountain lions did not like that either. Sorry,
oh, really?
Robert Frost.
So it was
Frost.
Just the voice. It wasn't it was the voice. Person. That's funny.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, some of you may not know if you've had a lion come to visit your neighborhood. I know where I live, Mount Helix area, there's been one spotted as close as a couple of houses away from me. None of us knew this until a neighbor went out late one night with a stream behind and saw one, and there was a second sighting nearby. But they do have some very unusual sounds, and it's not what you might think. This is not the MGM lion roar, or the Lion King kind of sounds. Tell us about that, Renee.
Yeah, and they're quite different, whether it's from African lions or jaguars. And some people will describe one as you've probably heard it described as a woman screaming. Well, that call is actually the female calling in mates.
Let's take a listen and hear what that sounds like. Wow, that would be kind of scary to hear at night.
Yeah, it's striking. Yeah. But interestingly, too, you can get this 100-plus-pound animal calling its kits or a big kit calling mom, and they don't sound like some large predator.
Let's listen to that. Wow, it almost sounds like birds chirping.
Yeah, yeah, and it can be even softer. So
if you hear that in the middle of the night, don't go out with your binoculars looking for the songbirds.
Yeah, so like I said, it's a mysterious creature regarding a lot of its movements and behavior. We are starting to open that door more and learn more. And one of the important things, getting back to this question of how many are there, I mean, there are not hundreds in San Diego County, I can tell you that. Hmm. But also, when we start looking at them as a number or a chess piece, we lose the concept that even when they're solitary, like this species tends to be, they still have an important behavioral dynamic within the population. And let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. More recent studies have shown that you'll hear a lot of hunters say, or agencies in other states say, well, we need to hunt them so that we will have reduced livestock predation, maybe, or fewer interactions, maybe. Well, the more recent research has shown that that doesn't work that way. In fact, hunters tend to go for the big trophies, and so the more hunting, the more you tend to get younger animals surviving, and they're more naive, mm-hmm. and they tend to be the ones that might be moving closer into urbanized areas.
It's a lot like with coyotes, I've heard, where if you kill the alpha male, you're just going to have another mm-hmm. one move right in, and they'll breed, and you'll wind up with even more of them than before.
It's true with so many species. When you remove the older, wiser animals, and we're usually talking about species where there is higher brain function and learning, but not necessarily. Even when you remove older fish, the dynamics of the population can change drastically. We need that as a bigger picture of how we manage these animals.
Fascinating. Well, they're just gorgeous animals. They're quite amazing. You've mentioned that when deer are not available, they're a little bit opportunistic, and that they can even eat other animals, including coyotes.
They do. And what they eat and what percentage of prey they eat varies somewhat, depending mm-hmm. on whether you're in Texas or here or Arizona.
Yeah, it might be cats or dogs, but, you know.
Yeah, but it's still always going to be deer and then maybe elk or maybe bighorn sheep, depending exactly where you are.
Yeah.
But they certainly will take other smaller animals,
especially raccoons,
porcupines. If you are the famous P-22 mm-hmm. in Los Angeles, and you have a tiny, isolated habitat of 9 square miles, maybe at most, mm-hmm. and it's hard to move around because of all the freeways, mm-hmm. they're going to start eating other things like porcupines, raccoons, house cats, coyotes, foxes.
Even hopped into the LA Zoo and helped himself to a koala.
And this one got a poor koala. Yeah. So it's not as simplistic a question that some people pose of a reduction in deer numbers. Mm-hmm. It's more one of movement and access. If you're a mountain lion and it's hard to move and there are other males around that will kill you, life gets complicated.
Well, we should mention on the pet issue that while certainly there are plenty of cases of mountain lions taking a cat or a dog, it's very common for coyotes to do that. And even hawks and hawks, eagles, owls will go after a small dog. Mm-hmm. So it's just a good idea, folks, to keep those pets inside, especially at night. A smaller dog probably all the time unless you're out there.
Exactly.
And
I mean, as humans, we think we're separate from nature, and this is the problem. We go about our day. We go to the grocery store. We lived in the city part of the time. But, you know, nature's always going to be there, and mm-hmm. it's always going to come uninvited or not. So we're the smarter ones. Yeah. So it's up to us to protect our animals, our pets, as best we can. And if we don't, shame on us.
Now, what about ourselves? If we like to go hiking or mountain biking or things like that back in these backcountry areas on the trails, what precautions should you take to make sure that you're protected against mountain lions?
Well, and that's a good question in that it's different than maybe if you've lived in bear country, what to do. It's different for mm-hmm. different species.
It is, yeah. And you don't. So, and I understand with one of those differences, with bear, they always tell you if you see a bear, you know, roll up in a little ball and put your hands over your heads. And that's exactly what you don't want to do with a lion.
Yeah. So lions, you want to try and intimidate them. If you really think there's a lion, you see a lion and it's not going anywhere, you get big, you make noise. You don't run. You don't play dead.
Mm-hmm. You hold your hands up and over your head and wave a walking stick around.
But so incredibly rare as a biologist doing surveys out in the field in remote areas for many years. I've seen them in the wild twice in California. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I've seen some also where I worked in South America, but still incredibly rare. So when people ask me, what do? I say, take a picture.
Yeah, there's only been a handful of fatal mountain lion attacks decades.
In 100 years in all of North America, and we're talking all of Canada and Mexico mm-hmm. as well, in mm-hmm. the past 100 years, 20 fatalities.
Yeah, so very, very few.
Even though I know it sounds scary to think of an animal attacking you, you are at much, much greater risk when you get in a car or your tub than when you are out hiking in mountain lion country.
What about carrying something like bear spray or pepper spray as a precaution, of course, not only against a mountain lion, but maybe a human predator?
Sure,
as well.
I do. I carry pepper spray. And like you said, I'm not really anticipating a mountain lion encounter. It's more so if there's a sketchy person maybe somebody with dogs who really are out of control. I've never had to use it.
Yeah, an aggressive
wild dog. But it just makes
sense.
Yeah.
Good point. Or a wild boar. Yeah. Some of those areas have those too. What else can we do if we care about protecting mountain lions? What else can we do locally to help give them a better chance?
To give them a better chance, there's one easy thing you can do without even leaving your house, and that's not to use rodenticides. So anything that kills rats, and it's not just a matter of you're putting out rat poison and mountain lions are going to eat rats. It's what we call bioaccumulation. So the mountain lions eat something that ate something that ate the rats.
Yeah.
And this, they are finding this in more and more mountain lions. They're really quite surprised. And it might not kill them right away. Sometimes it's the bioaccumulation really goes after their immune system and compromises it. And you'll see mountain lions having things like mange that is unusual for them. And so this is a growing problem. And there are more laws, you know, yay, California, we've got more rules now mm-hmm. banning certain types of rat poisons, but they're not all banned.
Yeah,
so
all of them are very harmful, not only to the lions, but to
owls, house
hawks,
cats,
coyotes,
you name it. Yeah, so we want to really move away from poisons.
We should say there are alternatives to poisons. Mm-hmm. For example, my property, you know, we have hawks that have moved in. Some people get owl boxes. Mm-hmm. One pair of owls or hawks can pretty well clear out a few square miles of rodents, I understand. My property, we have a gopher snake, and that snake is really welcome. One year, a neighbor killed a 6 or 7 foot gopher snake, and our yard looked like Caddyshack the next spring, and we were delighted when another gopher snake moved in. So that plus, you know, of course, traps the old-fashioned way, or now they have those electronic traps. There are a lot of other options.
There are other options, and it's, as you say, it's certainly the worst option is poison. And there's also things mechanical you can do if rats are your problem, excluding them from where you don't want them to be and removing attractants, garbage, things like that, and helping educate netting your neighbors. You know, if your neighbors have a bunch of trash out and the rats are going to wander over your place, maybe you could help them solve that problem.
Or putting nets over fruit trees, things like that. Mm-hmm. What else can people do to help mountain lions?
So being educated on exactly the role they play and why they're important does matter, because, you know, you don't protect something you don't care about.
Right.
And so learning the myths out there about how they're not dangerous predators stalking us or your children as a rule, and how they play an integral role, how they help maintain biodiversity, and the interconnected web that they are at the top of. And so protecting them is really protecting a whole lot of aspects of habitat. So it's kind of in one fell swoop. You know, when you create a functional wildlife corridor, they're not the only ones who are going to be using it. And we hit many millions of animals a year on our roads.
Yes,
and that has to stop.
I agree with you on that, Renee. There are also some organizations that you can support that are working to protect mountain lions and other animals. Obviously, there's the Mountain Lion Foundation. I think their site is mountainlionfoundation.org. That's one. Renee, tell us about your organization, which is locally based here in San Diego, Wild Zone Conservation League, which you can find at wildzoneconservation.org.
Yeah, thanks for that. We are a nonprofit that we've done research on various species. We don't do hands-on mountain lion research. What we really do is look at the interaction between the public and wildlife. And we've got some things going on right now. We do citizen science, and certainly not just with mountain lions. We do some with butterflies and birds and marine mammals. So there's some information on our website, but I welcome you to contact me at the email on our website with any and all questions. We're really good and always willing to come out to any venue and give a talk on something that has to do with our local habitats, our wildlife, that you have any questions about, from impacts and how we can prevent wildfire from harming our homes, to pest species, to things for children, for adults, and we gear our talks for the audience. So we'd love to come and chat with you about wildlife.
Well, that all sounds fascinating, and it's just such an important topic these days with development and climate change and rat poisons and freeways and all these things impacting not only the mountain lions like we've been talking about, but so many of our other species. A lot of people may not know that San Diego is one of the most biodiverse counties in America, and it'd be great to keep it that way.
Yes, it would. And it's a struggle. You know, we need, as our population grows, people have to go somewhere. And so you can see not only is the ecosystem connected, so many of our issues are connected to wildlife in ways you would never imagine. You know, when we promote corridors and ending sprawl, we're also promoting curtailing climate change and better high-density affordable housing in places that aren't out in the backcountry. So it really is all connected.
Yeah, it is. Renee, sometimes when a mountain lion is seen near people, as in occurred recently in Peñasquitos, where they unfortunately wound up killing a lion, we often hear that the lion is behaving abnormally. It's lost its fear of people. Is that true? Does that really happen very often?
No, it doesn't happen. And unfortunately, you'll read that a lot in the media. And it's a real knee-jerk reaction to the fact that mountain lions are out there and humans are out there. And the more we're out there in their habitat, the more we're going to come across each other. That does in no way mean that they've lost their fear of us. They're very afraid of us. And if they weren't, we'd be seeing a heck of a lot more of them, given how often we are out hiking and camping and doing whatever in the backcountry.
So that incident, it could have just been, what, a child that got maybe too close to a mother with cubs, something like that?
Or? Well, anything. I mean, a wild animal sees humans as a threat. So there are a host of different reactions that they can have. Usually it's just going to be to get away and avoid us. But before that happens, it might look at us, it might hiss, it might growl, it might check us out. Oftentimes when I've been tracking predators, I will find, depending on the species, whether it's a coyote or something else, if you're following one, or I found this with jaguar, where we study them in Venezuela, we'd be tracking them, and then before we know it, we'd be end up in a circle and find that they were tracking us.
Interesting.
So we are a threat, and some species like to keep an eye on us to make sure, say, like you said, if they do have a den or pups nearby, knowing where the threat is and being aware of it is important if you're a wild animal. So let's not interpret behavior of an animal looking at us, being around us, as losing their fear. It's just not accurate.
Right. Or even, you know, the rare case where there is an attack, it's certainly not indicative of all mountain lions everywhere.
No. And food is a very powerful motivator, though it still comes up against millions of years of evolution that say people are not on the menu, pretty much.
Okay. Well, I really want to thank you for joining us today. If you just tuned in, we have been speaking today with Renee Owens with Wild Zone Conservation League, which you can find out more about at wildzoneconservation.org. We've been talking about mountain lions and efforts to protect and save these beautiful animals here in California. Renee, thanks so much for joining us here today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
Thanks so much. This was a lot of fun.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine Radio Show. If you would like to be the media, here's your opportunity. We're looking for some more talented volunteers for our East County Magazine Radio Show. So if you've got radio experience or just a great voice, or if you'd like to get experience writing scripts or special reports for the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ, we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at 619-698-7617 or send an email to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We're your community media, bringing you news from our region that reflects the public interest, not special interests. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia, and the Smashing Beats. Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.